Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you out there in podcast land who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
His name is Jamie. He's the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm your movie guy, and we're here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love or have seen with a wine that he loves or is aware of.
Yes, wines that I am aware of.
Yeah.
We tell you why we like them, or if we don't, how they're made, why they work. Hopefully we find a pairing that works. Usually we don't. We are currently not remotely trying.
That's right. We are also currently not remotely trying to make updates when we copy-paste outlines from one week to the next. Because once again, this is apparently part two of Jamie's CMS tasting flight. This is part six of Jamie's Court of Master Somms wine taste testing Pepsi Coke challenge tasting flight. Jamie, we've done three whites. We've done two reds. By my math, that means we have one red remaining.
That is correct. And by the way, speaking of the Pepsi Coke challenge, in many blind tastings, basically no one can tell the difference.
I have done the Pepsi Coke challenge with dear friend of ours, Chris, formerly known as Dumpy. And while I failed the Pepsi Coke challenge, he failed the Pepsi Coke root beer challenge. That's how much that shit is all the same. And what matters is the label.
It's all just corn syrup.
Yeah, it's just corn syrup and fake sugar water and some bubbles.
Indeed. I mean, it's all delicious. Yeah, tastes real good.
Some of it's delicious. Some of it's too much.
I mean, yeah, like Mountain Dew Code Red. That's too much.
Mountain Dew Code Red. You know what? I can't even really do a Dr. Pepper anymore. Dr. Pepper is too sweet. That used to be my go-to.
Yeah, Dr. Pepper. Really, I'm only in for like a classic Coca-Cola, preferably the Mexican, like with cane sugar.
Yeah. Kind. The glass bottle.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm an old man. My go-to soda these days is a ginger ale. I like a ginge. That tends to be what I drink when I get a soda.
I like ginger ale too.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
So today we're pairing a movie with ginger ale.
With ginger ale, yes.
Surprise.
No, we've got our third red and final wine of the flight. Today we've got Monteriponi Chianti Classico 2020, which, if you're interested, is available from crushwineco.com for $29.99 plus tax and shipping.
But so ignoring all of those descriptors, I'm instead going for a thematic pairing with Jamie's miniseries. So he's hitting the books, getting prepared for his master exam, which has been taking me back to my time at undergrad when I occasionally went to classes. And so for my side of the miniseries, we're watching film school classics, iconic and foundational works of the Western cinema canon that I saw several too many times in film classes many moons ago during my undergrad education. Today's installment is Robert Flaherty's 1922 documentary feature, Nanook of the North. This is the first ever documentary feature, and the thing that kind of like shaped documentaries, and even like the term didn't really exist before this movie. You can at present stream it on whatever the fuck Max is. No, I kid. Max is the
dumbest marketing decision ever made.
It's the zombified shambles, the remains of my beloved HBO Max.
Home box office maximum.
Yep, but we don't need the home box office no more. HBO is only the best fucking brand that they got. Let's just not call it HBO no more.
Fucking weird.
It's dumb. Anyway, you can stream it on Max. You can stream it on Canopy with a card from a library with a participating Canopy membership. You can get it on the VOD, or the movie's 101 years old, so watch it guilt-free on YouTube because it's in the public domain. The public domain is still very much a thing. Thank you very much, Mr. Mouse.
Are we going to have a problem here? Ha-ha.
Well, I'm just that son of a bitch. It'll be... they're just going to extend it. The public domain is going to extend, and then it's not going to be 90 years. It's going to be 100 years.
Yep.
Just because they can't deal with fucking people putting Mickey Mouse on T-shirts... Or, you know, daycare centers spraying Goofy on the walls outside. Ugh. Anyway, before we get into it, Jamie, I have a little special segment here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, which is, this is our first recording since you have taken the theory portion of the exam.
That is correct.
Out in the Pacific North Left, up in Portland.
North Left.
How did it go? How are you feeling about your exam? I know you were stressed. I know you were worried. You were forgetting things. You forgot about New Zealand and their Sobby Bobby. How you doing?
Speaking of me forgetting things, there was a requisite question on the exam that I absolutely know the answer to, but that I could not, for the life of me, remember while I was in the room. And I mentioned this on our group chat, I think on our movie chat. This is a wine that you, Scott, and I have drunk together. This is a wine that I have drunk many, many bottles of. And the question was, what producer from Merfi produces the Cuvée Saint Anne bottling? I've had it a whole bunch, and I'm sitting there in the fucking room going, I just don't know the name of this producer. I can't do it. And like, then I stood with my head against the wall for 5 minutes after I've left the examination room, and it was like, fucking Charton Taillé, I have drunk this bottle a lot and I'm really mad. So if it turns out that I fail this exam by one question, I will be extremely upset. That's the worst case scenario.
Yeah, that would be terrible. I was gonna say something glib or do like a Simpsons reference, Mo Sizlak saying, "Welp, it's suicide again for me." But no, man, like, that sucks. I'm real sorry. Tests suck. That happens to everybody. It's been a while since I've taken a test, but like, yeah, that, you know, everybody, it's not even like you choked. You forgot a thing. There's a lot of shit that you've been cramming into your brain lately.
Yeah. And it's a verbal exam. And so you have to like, and it's timed also. So you got to keep it moving.
Yeah.
It's 104 questions, or this exam was 104 questions in 55 minutes. The question came like kind of towards the beginning of the exam, and I didn't want to waste a ton of time on it. So I sat there and was mad at myself for a minute, and then got sympathetic looks from both of the examiners when I said, I drink this wine a lot, but I can't remember the name. And then I said, another champagne producer, just as to say something.
Wait, is it a verbal?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like a proctored thing and there were like a bunch of you in a room with like number two pencils.
No,
it's the whole thing is verbal.
The whole thing is verbal. And once you once they begin the next question, you can no longer return. Yeah.
That's, I don't know, that there's a level of pressure there that feels unrealistic. Like you're a som out on the floor and you can't think of something. Like, you can walk away from the table and like fucking quickly Google in the kitchen, as I'm sure you people do all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And then come back like this. That is an extreme test of your knowledge and your ability to withstand pressure. I bet if it was a written thing, you'd have gotten it. It would have come back to you.
Right. I would have gotten to the end of the exam, then returned to that question and exactly. Like sat there for the remainder of the time until I like figured it out. Because I finished the exam with 15 minutes to spare.
Oh, man, that's brutal.
But yeah, I mean, part of it is like it is structured that way because of the pressure, because it's supposed to replicate service in some way. And I don't know that I fully agree with that, but whatever. It was a good exam. It was, I didn't think, overly difficult or overly like trivial. There were like a couple of, you know, the annoying like age statement questions or minimum residual sugar fucking questions, but there were also they had like some natural wine questions on the exam, some like more progressive stuff that was heartening for me. You know, these are the changes that I'm hoping to make when I get this certification.
Yeah,
but it was really fucking hard. I got a lot of things wrong, and we'll see if I made it over the finish line.
Well, I have faith in you, and I have admiration for the efforts that you put in. And I think you did great. And even if you didn't, you know, you'll fucking get them next time.
Thanks, man.
This might be a little premature, but I have a little gift for you.
Yeah.
It's either, this is a little token of my esteem. It's either, we can think of it as a victory dance for your success or a consolation prize for depending. Your failure. This is nothing super fancy here, but I got you a little t-shirt from one of my favorite vineyards. Let's see if. Oh, green screen. Are we?
Oh, I caught the. I caught it there for. Yep, Chateau Picard.
I'm gonna lay it in front of myself here so the green screen doesn't fuck it up. It's Chateau Picard, the official. It's a Grand Vin, Chateau Picard, Appellation La Barre Contrôlée.
Labarre?
L-A-B-A-R-R-E.
Okay.
Labarre. Product of France. Yeah. And it's got a little like ink sketch of the vineyard where the Picard family. I don't know. Maybe that's not a real appellation. Maybe, you know, after World War III and the first half of the 21st century, maybe all the appellations got changed. I'm sure all that thermonuclear war definitely changed the climate and the soil.
Yeah, I'm the first Google hit for Labarre is a wiki fandom page for Star Trek.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, boy. See, I brought it up and now I distressed myself. Also on the Memory Alpha wiki, which is the official or semi-official Star Trek wiki. Oh, boy. World War III, the nuclear war that sets the stage for the utopian future of Star Trek, canonically began in 2026.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
Yeah, nope.
Thank you, Mr. Roddenberry. We are moving on. So anyway,
thank you. That's a handsome gift. I very much appreciate it. I remember when which Star Trek was it that had Chateau Picard in it?
I believe the first time we find out the family has a vineyard is in season 4, episode 2. And this is an episode called Home. And this is right after Picard has been rescued and has been de-Borgified from his experience in the Best of Both Worlds as Locutus. And the ship goes back to Earth for, you know, repairs, and everybody visits with family. And Picard goes back to the family vineyard and fights with his brother, Robert, who is also a British Frenchman.
Were there bottles portrayed in that episode?
I don't. Probably, yeah. No, yeah, because the two of them have a fight in the mud, and then they get drunk in the house, and they crack open some bottles.
I thought there was something much more recent than that, because I have a memory of, you know, a lot of, on the internet, a lot of wine geeks showing photographs of the bottle portrayed.
Oh, well, yeah. So in the Paramount Plus show, Star Trek Picard, which is not good, he's retired and he lives at the vineyard. And so, like, you see bottles all over the place, at least until he goes to space and does space stuff.
Yeah, the small, but as you can probably guess, quite rabid crossover space between Star Trek nerd and wine nerd.
Two fan bases known for their relaxed, nuanced, and, you know, totally not hyper intense focus on the thing they love.
Yep. Very chill. Jesus. And normal people.
I don't want to meet these people.
They were complaining that the wine is supposed to be from Burgundy, but it is it's Chateau Picard, which is very rare. Chateaus are typically a Bordeaux thing. And the bottle portrayed was a Bordeaux style bottle, not a Burgundy style bottle.
It's fucking 400 years in the future, nerds. Get over it.
I know.
It's the 25th so fucking dumb. Century.
Yep.
Whatever. It's fine.
That was the thing about the Star Trek Picard series that, like, reached my ears. Was these fucking rabid nerds going, well, I bet he lives in Bordeaux.
Whatever. Whatever. Anyway, I have this nice t-shirt for you, Jamie.
Thank you.
It seems kind of soft.
No, it's gonna be great. I'm going to wear it a bunch, and I love displaying my nerditude.
Yeah. Well, it'll hit you on both levels.
Yes, indeed.
All right, but we're not talking about French Bordeaux and or Burgundy. We're talking about Chianti.
Chianti, which is these days typically bottled in a Bordeaux-style bottle.
You had to bring it back there, didn't you?
I did. These shoulders here, this is the Bordeaux style. And then the more sloped shoulders are the Burgundy-style bottle.
Hmm.
Although traditionally, Chianti was bottled in a bottle called a Fiasco. Those Ooh. Sort of like bulbous bottles that have the straw tied around them.
Yeah, if you've ever seen them. That's what I was expecting when Chianti, but no, that's not a thing. I only ever see those, I guess, the last time I was at an Olive Garden like 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of very, very bad Chianti has been bottled in Fiasco. And now there are like a few producers who are making like quality oriented, like bringing back the Fiasco with like good wine. But generally speaking, the movement was, if you're making good wine, you use like a more internationally acceptable bottle, like the Bordeaux bottle.
Hmm. Well, I hope if there's anything that I retain from this episode, and historical precedent would lead us to believe that there is not.
Nope.
But if I remember anything, I would really like to remember that those traditional Chianti bottles with the straw thing around it, it's called a fiasco, because that great name, excellent bit of trivia. Bring back the fiasco, please.
I agree.
Make it happen, Jamie. Tell your friends at the CMS.
Plural of fiasco is fiaschi, which also tickles me.
I like that less, but I still do like that.
Yeah.
All right.
So this is Chianti. You know, I think we've done the blind tasting rubric a number of times, a number of different ways. I think we can just sort of discuss the wine and how it makes us feel and what we like about it and what foods might pair with it. And then after that, we'll go into some specifics, like some of my grievances with the curriculum, as well as some things that I do actually find interesting.
Word.
What do you think?
Well, I haven't had any yet. I've been holding off. It smells nummy. Thank you for the warning. Jamie warned me last night, everybody, that I should open this bottle when I get up in the morning and let it breathe. So I don't know how much time you anticipated that being, but I get up at 6:30. So this thing has been breathing for a good, like, almost 5 hours at this
point. That's good. That's very good. Mine has been breathing for less than that because I got up at 8, but I didn't decant the bottle.
Plum, getting some plum, some of the dark fruit, some black fruit. Ooh, spicy. There's some spicy. Am I getting some bell pepper on there? Some of that green bell pepper?
So I wouldn't call it green bell pepper. There's something specific that I tend to get from Sangiovese that might sound odd to you, might not, but
I thought this was Chianti. Is Chianti the place? Chianti is the place and Sangiovese is the grape?
That's correct.
Italy, you bastards.
And we're going to get into it because there's Chianti and then there's Chianti Classico. And those are two different appellations and it's annoying. And they have different requirements. And the Chianti DOCG is much larger than the Chianti Classico DOCG. And it's, well, we'll get into it. But anyway, that vegetal thing... for me is like a little bit more resiny.
Like a bit of a tomato leaf thing.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Some tomato leaf there. I'm liking it. It's something in the ballpark of a savory, but definitely like strong plum on the nose.
I get a bunch of cinnamon too. And like,
yes, maybe that's the spice thing I was thinking.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Very tannic. Because
quite
it's
tannic, yeah.
Because it's the what now? What is the grape again?
Sangiovese.
Sangiovese, very, very tannic. Oh yeah, it's the tannin that like clings at the sides of the mouth and the roof of the mouth even. Ooh,
yep.
That is tannic. What else is going on in here? I'm enjoying the mouthfeel. It's got like I'm having a hard time seeing because my I don't have a white piece of paper here to look at. This has the watery rim, right? It's got that watery rim. Just a
it's
little bit.
Watery, but look a little closer. It has like almost an orangish hue at the rim.
But yeah, mouthfeel is nice where it's like it's we. This is what medium body,
yeah.
medium minus medium.
Yeah. With like medium plus, even possibly high tannins.
Yeah.
And a lot of acid, like medium plus acid.
And no sugar.
No sugar.
Is this bone dry or is this just regular dry? It's not dry.
Yeah, no.
Which is
no,
the middle.
No,
and it's not dry plus or no. Dry super plus.
Nope. I would not fault anyone for calling it bone dry. I would probably call it dry.
So you're saying there's the
it's
hint
like dry minus.
The hint of sugar.
No, not really. It's just like bone dry has a connotation of like it's very, very extreme. Like Barolo is bone dry. Barolo is like a step beyond this in tannin and acid.
Acidity. I'm again confused about red wine and acidity. I guess this is acidic because it's making me drooly.
Yeah, because you experience those tannins first and they dry you out.
Yeah.
And then you get a rush of saliva. It's an interesting experience.
I gotta tell you, I'm liking it. The tannin should be off-putting, but the package overall is really doing it for me.
Yeah, it's very yummy. I like it.
I want
it a lot.
This with food, though. I want it with meat.
Meat.
With some red meat.
Some fucking lamb chops, a big old steak.
Yeah, big ass steak. I mean, honestly, just like a nice, like thick, medium rare burger would be pretty great with this.
Yes, that would be lovely.
Yeah,
truly lots of American salt, cheese.
Some fat. And I'm sorry.
American cheese is the correct cheese for a burger.
With American cheese. I don't truck with American cheese. I'm sorry.
Listen,
I'm
sorry. Rafe Fiennes said it in the menu.
Okay.
That American cheese
said
can
many
melt.
Things in the menu. Like, here, look, I'm going to murder one of my servers.
No, he doesn't murder a server.
Oh, no,
but
the server
his
commits
chef kills
suicide?
Himself. The yes. sous chef.
The sous chef killed themselves at the urging of their boss. Fucking Voldemort killed that guy, okay, Jamie?
I fucking love that movie. It is yeah. so much fun.
It's so Jamie. Yeah. I thought that movie was good. I thought it kind of play or showed all of its cards pretty early. I also think there's a weird casting choice, which is just like, I love Anya Taylor-Joy. She's great. But her casting her as like the down-to-earth audience surrogate, like every woman character, like she looks like a fucking space alien. Like there's a reason you don't cast Tilda Swinton to play normal people. You can't
sure.
cast Anya Taylor-Joy to be the normal audience surrogate character because she came from Mars.
I don't disagree with you. I do think that her performance overcomes her appearance.
Yeah, she's
great. I think she's fucking great.
She's terrific in the movie. She's always good. I love her, but it's a weird audience surrogacy point. But for whatever faults I have with that movie, goddamn, that cheeseburger at the end of that movie
looks so good.
Top 10 all time on screen cheeseburgers. At some point I'll rank the on-screen cheeseburgers and I'll get back to you.
What other on-screen cheeseburgers are there,
I mean,
other than Pulp Fiction?
There's the Royale with cheese, a famous on-screen cheeseburger.
A really great on-screen cheeseburger. That's the first one that comes to mind, and I'm struggling to think of others.
Well, we're off topic already. Tell me more about Chianti and Chianti Classico and Chianti Classico Riserva and Chianti Classico Gran Selezione. And all
wow,
the other
that
things
was
that are
very excellent pronunciation there, Scott.
Selezione. Well, you know what? They spell it correctly, all right? It's not like it's spelled selection, but I have to know that the Italians say selezione.
Right.
The Z in there that really tells you where to go.
It gives you what you need, yeah.
Yeah.
So first of all, fully agree with you. I really like this wine. Monteriponi is a producer that I've loved for a long time. For me, like the Chianti is an area that I got really geeky on while I was working at Davio's, because I was running a relatively large list and I was able to get really in depth about certain appellations, in particular Amarone, Chianti, Barolo, Barbaresco, and then Napa Valley Cabernet. And I really developed a preference for Chiantis that come from the village of Rada, R-A-D-D-A, including producers like Montevertini, who, like, I don't drink anymore because white people ruin everything and there's rampant racism going on and all of that shit. But Istinay and a number of others that make this sort of, like, more elegant style of Chianti. While it does have a ton of tannin and acid, it doesn't knock you out. As you say, like, you think the tannin would put you off, but it's well integrated and it's a pleasant drinking experience, kind of even without food. Although this with a steak fucking kills. Just like a simple, well-seasoned, medium rare steak.
I mean, I'm not going to say the experience is lacking, but I'm trying to use my imagination to conjure the experience of having this with a bite of steak. Because you didn't call me out, but you illuminated recently that I'm in my I don't like this phase.
Yes.
Of nascent wine interest. And I don't want to be that. I don't want to just be a contrarian who doesn't like things. And I wasn't consciously being that way. But like, I know that some of the tannic ones I've had recently have been very off-putting to me. And I used to like the dark red tannic big boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to come at it more openly. And it is. The tannin level, truthfully, is a little off-putting, but
it's
like
a lot.
I'm trying to get past it and also just trying to enjoy the sensory experience because it's weird and it could be unpleasant, but like I know it's not a danger. so my higher brain can tell the part of my body that's like, hey, mouth, this is probably poison. You should spit this out. And I'm just trying to groove with it.
Well, I appreciate that open-mindedness. And also, like, we're dealing with Italian wine. Like, your European wine culture in general is to have a couple of glasses with dinner, with lunch, whatever. Like, it's all about consuming these things with food. Americans, as we do, kind of bastardize things. And so they're, you know, the American style of wine is much more geared to, you know, a thing that you can just drink without food. And so something like this would absolutely get opened when someone was grilling, you know, steak fiorentine or, you know, or some lamb chops or a burger or whatever. But I think it straddles that line pretty well. Like, it will, it does want food, but we can still enjoy it. So that all having been said, I in our little outline here sort of copy pasted some of the minutiae from Guildsom being the educational arm of the Court of Master Sommeliers, where sort of a lot of the wine law and climate and geography and all of that shit gets compiled. It's a really, really great resource.
Why is it called Guildsom? Is it, there's the court, and then is there also a guild? Are you guys a union?
We're not a union, no. Guildsom is a misnomer. It's not actually like a guild.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because you guys could be out striking with the WGA.
We could.
And putting pithy jokes about Pinot Grigio on your strike signs.
Well, Soms are not as funny as we think we are.
Definitely not as funny as professional writers.
Definitely not that funny. Correct. And, you know, certainly less funny than a lot of other professionals out there. We're not the least funny of professions, but we're not the most funny.
No, but when I conjure in my mind the image of a Somm, I don't think of somebody cracking jokes on the floor of a restaurant, you know? A Somm is at best bemusing. Anyway, please continue.
So I sort of copied and pasted some of this stuff that is, this is just the Chianti Classico article that I copy pasted. There is also a Chianti article, and then there are several other Sangiovese only appellations of Tuscany that have their own rules for the appellation, their own regulations. So this tells us from the top down, the region that it's in, which we know, the provinces, the communes of production. When it says commune, you're talking about like a municipality, essentially. So Castellina, Rada, Gaiole, Castelnuovo, Berardenga, which I always have trouble pronouncing, and Poggibonsi, and, you know, and Greve, and all, whatever. There are a ton. And then there are a ton of subzones that like sort of subdivide those things. And we're all sort of expected to know those things. And I don't have a problem with that, because I should know the specific municipality. And there is a difference between Sangiovese grown in Greve versus Sangiovese grown in Rada. But then you get into this, like, so look at the varieties area. 80 to 100% Sangiovese. Maximum 20% other red grapes authorized by Siena and Firenze, including, among others, Colorino, Canaiolo Nero, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot. And then, as of the 2006 vintage, Trebbiano Toscano and Malvasia Bianco are no longer allowed. This is different for Chianti DOCG, which is 75 to 100% Sangiovese, does allow for some white grapes and has different red grapes that are allowed.
But what we're looking at here is Chianti Classico, and they're different for reasons.
So whenever you see Classico on an Italian wine label, what that means is it's a smaller area with inside the larger appellation that is considered to be the classic area of production, the more historically accurate or the better area of production. So Suave has a big area, and then Suave Classico is a lot smaller.
Okay. None of this seems offensive so far, but the problem is
memorizing all of this minutia. Like, does me knowing that Chianti can be 75% Sangiovese while Chianti Classico needs to be minimum 80%, does that make me a better wine professional?
I'm going to advocate for the devil and say, yes, it does. Because then you have more minutiae available to you to confound and mystify and ensorcel your clients, and then you can get them to spend more by just throwing vocabulary at them.
Here you go, making the capitalist argument.
I'm just saying that we clearly laid it out in a recent episode that y'all are the middlemen, and that all of this could be clearer and less confusing, but y'all have to obfuscate it to protect your salaries and to protect your place in the beverage industry. So yeah, that's what I'm saying. You have to know all the Chianti stuff so that you don't give up the game. You can't just go up to a table when they're looking at the wine list and be like, don't worry, all the Chiantis are the same. It doesn't really matter. 75%, 80%, fucking whatever. It's fine. It's fine. You can't do that.
Nope.
Great. So you agree. It will make you a better wine professional because part of the job is the grift.
It's not a grift.
Isn't it though?
It feels a little bit like a grift, but like, as we also talked about on our last recording, these appellations were largely created to stop counterfeiting, you know, as an advocate for the consumer. And all of the appellations are local in nature. And so that means that there's a lot of unevenness across the globe. And that is the thing that makes it necessary for people like myself to dive really deep. But on this specific point, like fucking 5% of Sangiovese doesn't make a fucking difference. Chianti, Chianti Classico, these are all Sangiovese-based appellations. And I'm going to gravitate towards wineries that want to use, you know, the native grapes of the region anyway. So I'm going to dive deep and see, like, is there Merlot in your blend? If there is, maybe I'm a little bit less interested. Maybe I'm more interested in 100% Sangiovese or something that has Colorino and Canaiolo in it, because these are the grapes that have historically been here.
But what if adding Merlot makes it nummier? Wouldn't you like that more?
I would. Yeah, I do. I do like things that are more delicious, but I also like things that speak about a place that you know, that tell us this is the way we do things here. This is the way we have done things here. And maybe these French varieties don't have a place, or they have a different place.
But this is the way that they do things here. And because it's the Classico, this is the way that things have been done here, right? Aren't they just preserving the way things are done there,
well,
and the way things have been done?
You want that to be the case. But in fact, in the 14th century, when Chianti was first, the first written mention of Chianti comes from the 13th century, those wines were white wines. And they were lauded and celebrated, and they were poured at the courts of the dukes of the different municipalities of Italy. But it absolutely was unrecognizable as what we now know Chianti to be.
Okay.
So like these appellations preserve a thing that exists now, maybe existed for some time in the past, but it's certainly not like an immutable truth. And my preference for Italian varieties over French varieties in Italy is just that. It's a personal preference. I'm not making a value judgment. But for me, when I drink Chianti, I would like it to be mostly Sangiovese. It has the attitude of Italian wine that I love so much. A little extra tannin, a little extra edge, a little bit more rustic, not so smoothed out the way the French varieties can be.
Is this one smoothed out with things like Merlot and Cabernet?
This is 100% Sangiovese.
Hundo P.
Hundo P.
Or a Hundop.
I don't try to make
that happen. I like Hundop.
No one else likes that.
Well, I can tell because I've mentioned it several times in our group chat, and it's been fucking crickets.
Just ignored.
People just move right along, or it just kills the conversation for a day. I even spelled it out phonetically one time, moving right along, talking about Dan's baby or whatever.
I don't understand your Hundop thing. I think Hundo P is just very funny.
I don't have a problem with Hundo P. Keep it 100. It's great. 100%, Hundo, Hundo P. These things are all great. Hundop is just fun for me to say.
Okay.
I like it ending with that hard consonant, that dop sound. That's a nice syllable to say. Hundop.
Okay. You're bringing me around to your way of thinking, Scott.
It's just fun to say.
Hundop.
When in doubt, whenever you dig your heels in about some nonsense word that I made up or adopted or adapted, like the thing that you're not realizing is that these words are fun to say.
So like moving down the list of other sort of minutiae.
This is just like when I said Hundop in group chat, where everybody just moved along just and didn't want to talk about
right
it
the
anymore.
Fuck along. I'm
all
done.
Right, fine. I'm muting
I'm
myself.
Done,
please
Scott.
Go ahead.
Then the Gran Selezione label is like very, very new to Chianti Classico, and it mandates a higher level of Sangiovese. The idea is like, we're going to make higher quality wines under this, new designation within Chianti Classico. I think that's cool. I think it's important for me to know that it is a higher quality. I think maybe it's important for me to know that it's a higher, percentage of Sangiovese specifically. What I don't find to be particularly important is the minimum alcohol percentage, which changes. Chianti Classico has to be 12%. Reserva has to be 12.5. Gran Selezione has to be 13. And then maximum residual sugar is 4 grams per liter, where in some dry wine appellations, it's 6 grams per liter. And in others, it's 5. And it's like, why is this important to anyone other than someone making wine in this region? I've never seen a Chianti Classico at 12% alcohol. They are much more commonly 13.5, 14, 14.5. The reason that those things exist, that those regulations exist, is so that people aren't picking too early. So they're trying to preserve a level of quality, a level of ripeness, so that, you know, it can be tempting to get your fruit off the vine early because you avoid disease pressure. And so you're trying to stop people from doing that. But by and large, people don't do that. And so I don't really find it valuable to put these things into my head. Same with aging requirements. Aging requirements are the thing that, like, if you want to get me from zero to pissed off really quick in a study session, like, let's talk about aging requirements in the different places, because it varies so much from place to place. And isn't it enough that I know that Reserva is aged longer and, like, fuck, whatever. And Gran Selezione is aged even longer than that. I don't want to memorize that Chianti Classico may not be released until October 1st of the year following the harvest, while Reserva requires a minimum 24 months of aging from January 1st of the year following the harvest, including 3 months in bottle. You're not allowed to go directly from barrel to bottle and then sell. You have to let it rest. And I know that there are reasons here for the winemakers and for the appellation, but for me, on the floor of a restaurant, if I were to talk to you about this shit, you would immediately glaze over and not buy what I'm selling.
I would just point to the kitchen and tell you to go back there and send me someone who spoke a language that I was familiar with.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So you are talking about what is practical information, because for a minute there, you kept saying that you didn't want to memorize it, and like, fucking stop whining, Jamie. I'm so sorry that you have to memorize things for this voluntary exam that you've elected to take. Like, oh no, my fancy pin means I have to learn things from books and I don't want to. Like, nobody wants to memorize anything.
Yeah, memorizing shit is annoying.
That's what these terrible, stupid things are for.
Phones?
Yes. I don't know if the background thing occluded my phone there, but it was my phone. Yeah.
It did. No, I'm legitimately talking about things that I find to be practical. And
you don't need to know it. If your job is about service, you don't need to know things that you will never convey to a customer.
Right. It's important for me to know that the aging requirements ascend and why they ascend. It's important for me to know why minimum alcohol requirements exist. But the specific ones are unimportant for anyone other than someone trying to put a label on a bottle in this region, in my not very humble opinion. I mean, it's important for me to understand why the minimum planting density here is 4,400 vines per hectare. Like, I understand that you want to have densely planted plants so that you are not fostering extreme vigor, so that quality is preserved. Vigor being growth, like green growth of the vine, okay, and extra fruit. As we've discussed, more fruit from a single vine will, in general, create lower quality wines. You want fewer bunches.
You want concentration stage.
Concentration, correct. And so, you know, in a place like this, you want the vines to be competing with one another. And so 4,400 vines per hectare, that makes sense. I understand that there is a, that there is an underpinning to this regulation, but the value of me being able to pull that statistic, I don't see. I just really don't see that. You know, what is interesting and important is that the soils of the region are Galestro, Albarese, and Machino. And knowing what those are and what their effects might be on the flavor of a wine, and knowing which communes of Chianti are richer in which of those soils, that I find to be valuable.
That all seems very reasonable. That sounds great. You got yourself all worked up and hot and bothered, but yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I think that there's so much about wine that we don't talk about in these SOM exams that I really do find valuable, that I find interesting, that I think that guests might find interesting. You know, like, it, not every guest is interested in knowing that in the 1300s, Chianti was a white wine. Not every guest is interested in knowing that Chianti was actually the first ever delimited appellation in the world in the 1770s.
Not every guest would even know what that means.
Correct. But some of them do. And for those of you out there who don't know, the idea is that this was the first place in the world where someone drew a line on a map, and within this line, there you can call this Chianti, and outside of it, you can't.
So these are my enemies then. No. I've come around on your appellation system, because after framing it in a way to enrage me for like 3 years,
yep,
you finally reveal that it's actually like basically a consumer advocacy thing, and it's trying to make shit easier for us. And so, no, I'm fine with that. These are my friends. The whoever demarcated the delineation of Chianti. All right.
It was Cosimo III de' Medici, Grand Duke of Tuscany.
What, one of the Medicis?
Yeah, but a much later one. This is right. In 1716.
This is a post-Renaissance Medici.
Yes.
This guy was likely not a patron of the great Ninja Turtle painters.
No,
but
his family was.
15th and 16th centuries. Okay.
But like this is also, I also find a lot of this to be very interesting. Like the first mention of Chianti was in 1398, right? That was prior to the Renaissance, but it signaled its mention at that time signals a shift in global power toward Tuscany, specifically Florence and Siena. And that's where the Renaissance happened. And so you can sort of track what's going on in the art world, what's going on politically, what's going on with different wars and in commerce, based on what wines become important when. And largely, you know, it does become a story of English colonialism. You know, you have the English market is such an important market for wine. And so in the 1700s, Chianti starts being really important in England. And that's just because England just spent a whole bunch of time fighting France, and they don't want to buy French wine anymore. So they look to Italy, and then eventually they look to Spain, and then even farther afield in Hungary. One of the reasons why the Court of Master Sommeliers, as I have said, centers these specific wines can be their historic significance. It's money for sure. Also, these are historically significant things. They track the rise and fall of empires and the tastes of the time and all of those things. And I find that history to be valuable, to be interesting, and to give us context on our global wine tastes now. But I also think it's really important to be talking about what new things are happening, what innovations are happening, what does Trousseau Gris from Sonoma taste like, and why do we think that it has a place there, if we even do, and opening up that conversation rather than just continuing to, I don't know, live in this like early 19th century or early 20th century world where we're trying to preserve the previous century, where we're trying to preserve the 19th century appellations, the Burgundies and the Rhones and the Champagnes and the Chiantis and the Tokais and the Douros, etc. They're important. They're important historically, but they're not the only thing. And there's a ton of other wines out there that do what Chianti does, that I think it's valuable, especially for Somms to know about. You know, we don't have to be shouting Ciro from the rooftops. Ciro is an appellation for Gagliopo in southern Italy, in Calabria. And those wines are powerful, but kind of lighter in body in a very similar way to Chianti. They have sort of this rusticity that reminds me of Chianti. The general public doesn't necessarily have to be conscious of it, but for Somms to be, and to put it on their lists and to advocate that people maybe step outside of their comfort zone, like that's what we do. That's the power of this position that we have, is to show people other areas that are less famous, advocate for those winemakers, and in so doing, give those winemakers maybe a little bit more economic power so that they can make their wines better the next vintage. Which, by the way, is why these other wine regions are so fucking dug in. The more money you get for your bottle of wine, the more you can reinvest in the winery and the vineyards and make better wine the following vintage. So of course Burgundy's fucking great, because the price continues to rise and rise and rise, and there can be further investment, and there's also like really involved community and international interest. I've been on a tear.
You've been on a bit of a soapbox, and I didn't want to cut in because you were making some salient points. That I think I agree with. But yeah, I agree.
I was working myself up.
No, I mean you're ranting things that I largely agree with. It's funny, we do keep finding these interesting parallels. Thank goodness one of us thought to find thematic parallels to your miniseries and not to the individual wine descriptors.
Mm-hmm.
How insightful I was. I was just thinking.
How insightful you are, Scott, not was.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just thinking while I was prepping for this ep and rewatching Nanook of the North, how weird it is and how strange it is that some of the movies that we've covered this miniseries, how many times I saw them in school. Like, I vividly remember my first film class was in when I was at community college. And it was like, you know, a late night screening course. And this, bless her heart, she was trying, but this was not the best instructor. And she had, you know, a bunch of like 19 and 20 something. We weren't even called millennials back then. But like people who were just not largely engaged with what she was putting on screen. But also like, the shit she was putting on screen was not super engaging. Like, I know it's the first documentary, but why is Nanook of the North the first documentary you show to film students?
Which That's happened a good to question.
Me at two different schools. Like, you can teach people, you don't need to, like, if you're, you can teach a history of film that can be separate from intro to film. Why do we need to start at the beginning? Why, if you want to teach people about documentary form and about how documentary works, why do you start with a movie that is, spoilers, compromised and is 100 years old when you could start with a much more recent example that has a language that maybe engages your student body a little bit more? Like a great documentary, something we've talked about on the show, you could show students Minding the Gap. And you could use that to talk about documentary form and the point of view of a documentarian and the blurry line between subject and filmmaker and between observer and interlocutor in the actual process and the events that you're depicting. And then you can work backwards and you can get to Nanook and you can talk about it because it's important. We should talk about it. But like, why are we starting there with something that like it was so alienating? Like there's stuff in the movie that I find engaging, but like I just remember my classmates tuning out every time I saw this movie, and I think I saw it three times. across my film schoolings. It was really only when I got, it was like my last year of school, and I had, I forget what the name of the course was, but she was a, I think she was a grad student who was teaching it. And it was basically like, it was a film theory course. And it was like the first time I had watched a bunch of movies in one of these classes that were made in the last 30 years. Like we watched Do the Right Thing, and we watched A Wong Kar Wai, and we watched, what the fuck was it? We watched Zhang Zimu's Hero, and we watched this great American documentary called Trouble the Water, which is like one of the two essential docs about Katrina and the American response post Katrina.
Oh boy.
And like, that was the first time that I was, it felt like that the movies that we were being shown in class weren't just homework. Like we were able to engage with stuff because it was compelling and it spoke a more familiar language. And like, not that you need to shape your education on these things just to the modern taste, but like, you can't ignore them either. And you got to talk about what people want to talk about if you want them to be engaged in it.
I was going to say, yeah, bringing people in with some context that maybe they already have and then building on that, which means then going back into the past, right? For wine education, like, why do we start with bottles of Burgundy that are in excess of $200 per bottle? Like, that's alienating just from an economic standpoint. Like, if these are the important wines, well, then I guess wine's not important to me because I can't fucking afford it.
Yeah, it just feels like it's rote memorization. They want to teach you the stats on the back of the Chianti, you know, rookie trading card. But like, you need to learn, like, you need to learn it more substantively, right? Like, it's not just about recitation and memorization. And this is how Chianti is made. Like, you want a more intuitive understanding. You want to understand how and why more than just what and when.
Right. And to your point about bringing people in with, you know, something maybe more modern, you know, a good example would be Istinè. They're a producer in Chianti, not very far from Monteriponi. It's a group of, I think, three youngish guys. And they've been making real waves, and they're making rosé, which is typically frowned upon in the area, and they're making white wine, and they're making some really beautiful Chiantis that lean more into elegance, grace, lighter tannins, lower maceration times, more to the taste of younger wine drinkers today. And you could use that producer as a way to talk about the way things have been in Chianti. And the maybe why this is a reaction to those things. And then you can also use those bottles to talk about, to go back and talk about Burgundy and the model that Burgundy offered and why French appellation became the model the world over. You start with something, Istinè Rosé, which is Sangiovese Rosé, which is just simply delicious. It's like bubblegummy and tutti frutti, but it's dry and it's clean and it's serious, and you could use that bottle to then go back and talk about sort of the expansiveness of wine history. And why aren't we doing that? And instead we're doing, well, the minimum residual sugar for Sauternes is blah blah blah, and the minimum aging requirement for Barolo is 50 months, whatever. Like, fuck, boring, not interesting. Scott's falling asleep right now.
Anyway, yeah, I think we've been circle jerking enough. We agree. You had a soapbox. You said a thing. I agree with that. You agreed with me agreeing with you, which is the fucking Jamiest thing that ever happened. yeah.
Yeah. We need to change the framework both for film education and for wine education. And, you know, there are just, This is the whole thing with this miniseries, right? Like, I do find value in a lot of what I have taken from the curriculum of the court, but I think that there's a better way, and I would like for us to do better. Speaking Cheers. Of doing better,
what?
Nanook of the North, can we do better?
Can we do better than? Did you not like Nanook of the North? Like, look, the movie has problems, but like, It is a very engaging and compelling and at times thrilling piece of filmmaking.
I don't know that I agree with that.
You're a stupid butt. You didn't. All right, whatever. Let's get into it. I don't have a background to change. So we watched Nanook of the North. As mentioned, you can watch it on Max, whatever Max is. And if you have the canopy or if you have the Yub Tub, you can watch it that way as well. It's a 1922 documentary from, at that time, first-time filmmaker Robert Flaherty. It's the first ever feature-length documentary. It came out before we were calling these things documentaries, before the term had entered the lexicon or before the form had taken shape. This is like the prototypical, what they would come to call an anthropological documentary. So just a scotch of background. So Flaherty started filming this with the Inuit in the early 1910s on a series of expeditions. He was funded by some fucking British lord who sent him up there. And like on a whim, he brought up a still camera and a film camera. He wasn't a filmmaker. He had taken the briefest, I think it was like maybe a 3-week training course at, I believe, the Kodak campus on camera operation and film processing.
In Rochester, New York?
I believe that is the very one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And his initial thinking was that he would just bring a camera along and he would make something kind of in the mold of the Actualities, which we have mentioned previously on the show. These were the then dominant form of nonfiction filmmaking, pioneered by the Lumiere brothers. We've discussed them. They were the two Frenchmen who like invented the first motion picture camera and also projection system. And their Actualities, the first films that they made, were like 60 seconds long. And they would plunk the camera down outside their warehouse or a train station, and you would just observe behavior. Actualities had kind of grown where if in the 19, you know, aughts or early 10s, like you would go to a movie theater and you would see a travelogue where somebody went to some quote unquote exotic locale and they would, you know, start recording and you would see what it looked like to be in Tahiti or in Timbuktu. Or Actualities would be about recording and presenting a process, like the process of working in a factory or what train operation looked like. Flaherty effectively combined both with this movie. He was up there between like 1910 and 1916 for a series of expeditions. He filmed a lot, like a stupid ass when he got back to the States. He dropped a lit cigarette on his nitrate negative. Nitrate, famously combustible.
Yeah, and why lost... the fuck were you smoking, asshole?
Well, Jamie, it was 1916. Like, everybody smoked all the time. You smoked in your bed, okay? He lost 30,000 feet of film, years of his work, but he had made essentially like an exhibition print from that negative that he had continued to show. And while he wasn't happy with the results, the response was very enthusiastic. So he goes back up.
Can I ask a question?
You can always ask a question.
What was the primary mission of his expeditions? Like, why was he funded by this lord? Obviously, you've said that the film equipment was on a whim.
It was sort of ancillary. He was going up there and learning about the people. Like he was kind of like a prototypical anthropologist.
Okay.
He was observing. He was studying. He spent time up there. He fell in love with the Inuit people. Like he genuinely had a great admiration and a respect for them, that today we probably would describe as like paternalistic. But like the admiration is real, and that's why he kept going back and spending so much time up there. So he goes back up, and his intent now, after destroying his original filmic product that he wasn't happy with, what an idiot, but his intent on this next set of expeditions is to focus on a single character, which is how he describes it in the opening title cards of Nanook of the North. And between 1920 and 21, he filmed what would become Nanook of the North, which is the first ever feature-length nonfiction film. The movie presents the daily life of a family of Inuit hunters. It focuses primarily on the patriarch of the family, Nanook, who is a famed and successful hunter, we are told. The movie depicts Nanook hunting walruses and seals. We see him fishing in a genuinely thrilling sequence of just like process observation. We see him construct an igloo out of packed snow. We see him caring for his children, breaking up fights between his sled dogs, and the film does so largely with admiration and respect for Nanook's character and his bravery. It's a fascinating slice of life kind of documentary. It's a window into a cultural way of life that even as he was filming it, Flaherty knew was basically on its way towards extinction. And at times, I think it's absolutely thrilling to witness. Jamie, apparently you have other thoughts. You didn't find the walrus hunt exciting?
Not particularly. I don't know.
The walrus hunt is super thrilling, where he's wrestling, like trying to pull the seal on a fishing line out of a hole in the ice. Super exciting. Breaking up the fight with the dogs. Just the process of watching this guy with the precision and the confidence of an expert use a fucking bone knife to carve up snow and build an igloo, like seemingly effortlessly. We talked about this before. It's fun watching people be good at their jobs.
Yeah.
And this motherfucker is great at like surviving in a frozen tundra.
It's true. I enjoyed the fishing sequence a fair bit, where he's like using the lure and then he's that like really cool tool that he's got for snaring the fish.
Where it's like a spear with like two things on the side that kind of like grab.
It's like
a trident, but I think the things on the side are kind of like a grabber
mechanism. They've got like a spike going the opposite direction. So when you grab around, it then snares the thing. I thought that was super cool. I don't know. Overall, I just wasn't grabbed. Like the specific sequences that you're referencing, I do find interesting and thrilling. In particular, the pulling the seal up through the ice, or the hunting portion of it, like identifying the hole where the seal breathes, and then waiting there for the seal to come up and breathe, and like all of that, super duper cool. But you mentioned the word paternalistic, like the tone of all of the title cards.
The intertitles is what we call them.
Intertitles.
Yes.
Is, you know, that of that time and talking about people who are other than white.
It's a little patronizing.
It's extremely patronizing. And I'm not saying, like, obviously it was the time. I'm not faulting the guy, but for me, that I find that less than interesting to engage with.
It's a little off-putting to read someone being described as a credit to their race.
Sure is.
Yeah, it's not great.
And the way they like engage with white man and the gramophone sequence. Where
he's biting the record.
Biting of the record. Oh, my God. I had fucking forgotten about that.
The biting of the record is really bad. And you're not going to be surprised to hear this, that was a Flaherty suggestion.
Of course.
And that was some nonsense, and that the actual man was very familiar with the gramophone and, you know, had used them before.
Yep. So it's the overall tone that put me off. The specific sequences that you're talking about, I do agree, are thrilling and interesting and engaging. But the overall experience of watching the thing, like, I don't want to go back and watch it again.
I mean, I don't want to go back and watch it again, but repeat viewing is not like, you know, the minimum bar for me. Like I think it's engaging. I think it's a great slice of life. For all the overarching, like, you know, white man's point of view that kind of frames around the thing, I still think it works. I still think, not as a character study, but as a document of process, I find it fascinating. I just find it interesting watching him do all this stuff. The way that he uses the, what is it? It's walrus ivory that he uses as a knife, and he licks it so that it instantly freezes and becomes ice so that it can carve through the snow more easily. And he just like, how quickly he's able to construct that structure is just, you know, it's exciting. It's exciting to watch. And you're like, oh man, this thing's going to come collapsing in. Like, no man, this dude knows what's up. He's built plenty of igloos in his time.
A lot. An awful, he's obviously got a practiced hand. I don't know. I think that this is, you mentioned the parallel between like what's important and what, and the context, you know, between film and wine. And I think this is one of those things that like may be important for a film professional to know about, and to engage with and to understand about the process. But for the rest of us, like, I don't feel enriched having watched this thing. And I didn't particularly enjoy watching it either.
Wow.
Just not my cup of tea. and so, like, by the same token, like, is it super important for you, Scott Hudson, to have tasted any of, much less all five of the first growths of Bordeaux? I don't think so. And in the end, I'm not sure that you would enjoy the experience of drinking those wines.
I haven't done that, right?
You have not done that.
I have not done that. Okay, thank you.
I have tasted all of them. I have, you know, gone to the trouble of making sure that I'm in the room when they're open, or spending the money to be sure that I, like, understand how these things taste, you know, as context for the wider world of wine. It's not a thing that I'm going to go, you know, showing to all of my friends, partly because they're phenomenally expensive, but also partly because I don't find them that interesting to have, you know, over dinner with friends.
I'm shocked. I expected you to come in here with blistering 2023 woke Twitter hot takes about how offensive this movie was to your sensibilities.
I mean, that's part of it.
Which
it's
largely share, but you didn't even find it.
Isn't it?
It's complicated.
His name is not Nanook. What's his fucking name?
His name is Nanook. The movie is a documentary. It prevents truth as reality as it was captured by the camera.
Motherfucker.
Why would you question that, Jamie? Don't scroll ahead in my fucking outline.
I also
figured out phonetically how to say this man's name. You are not saying it on microphone before I will.
Okay,
thank you very
sure.
much.
But was he compensated for his time?
You know what? That I don't actually know.
Right. And probably not. And his name is definitely not the one that we remember. Robert Flaherty's is.
Yeah. Look, I'm not defending it on these grounds. What I'm saying is, this is what I expected from you. And it seems like you made, like, a hand-waving complaint about that, but really you just kind of found it boring.
Yep.
And I'm like, look, I have the same ethical quandaries with this movie. I have more ethical issues with this movie than you do. But, like, watching that man sneak up on some walruses and then the walruses start to get alarmed, like, that is just viscerally thrilling stuff. Watching him sitting there over the icy water and just, like, bobbing his, you know, like, rudimentary fishing rod, and then the 1998 newly added score is, like, you know, rhythmically going along with his bobbing, and then he catches a fish, like, that's just exciting.
I was going to ask you about the score. So that's a new score.
There was a score. Like, silent movies were often presented with an accompaniment, but it's not like the movies showed up with sheet music. You know, like, some of them did, but for the most part, those scores were like the accompanists were like great musicians. And so they would watch the movie once and they'd be like, all right, here I'm going to play this, and here I'm going to play this, and here I need something jaunty, and here I need something romantic, and here I need something exciting. And it would be different every time. You've never seen a silent with a live accompaniment, right?
No.
It's genuinely thrilling. It's like, it's an extra special thing when the one time we went recently, we took my son to see a couple of Buster Keaton movies. I think we saw Sherlock Jr. and it was preceded by The Goat, one of his 20-minute, like, two reel shorts. And the accompanist is a guy who, like, travels all over the country with, you know, his own equipment and does accompaniments. And he's very, like, studied, and he's like a student of the history of these things. And he'll be like, look, what I'm going to be doing is improvising. Like, there, I've played before these movies a bunch of times. There are going to be, like, some melodies and some phrases that I've used before, but, like, it's all just going to be kind of coming out of me as I'm watching the movie again with you. And this will never, if you recorded this, it would never sound exactly the same as I've done it before. You know, cause it's like, it's a world-class musician, like somebody who can just riff that much and just invent phrasing on the fly. But yeah, this is a new score, that came with the 1998. It was a Criterion DVD back then, which is the same, like, DVD transfer that's on Max right now. And I guess there's just, like, not a lot of demand to do, like, an HD or a 4K remaster of Nanook of the North. Because, like, obviously the film material is 100 years old and it's grainy. But, like, the issue with this transfer is just how pixely it is. Like, we're still looking at something that was mastered for, like, a 480p medium. which I was a little disappointed by. But yeah, the score, I believe, commissioned by or for the Criterion release 25 years ago, is kind of like the, you know, what is currently the only available, like, official score for the movie. Although there's others out there. I think Frank Zappa wrote a couple of songs inspired by this movie that I think are maybe meant to be played on top of it, which could be interesting.
I'd be down.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's exciting. It's exciting to watch. I can't help you.
But it's like, also
it's fake. Problematic.
None of it's real.
Stop looking ahead. You're not allowed to look ahead at the outline. I do you the courtesy of not reading ahead in your outline and not being interested by it.
You should
do me that same courtesy.
I also read the Wikipedia article on
You son of a bitch. My primary resource. No, I read more than Wikipedia. It's not that it's fake. All right. First, let's just give Flaherty credit for what he did right, okay? Because it's a foundational piece of documentary text for a reason. He did a lot of things that, like, kind of shaped a lot of documentary form to come. So, for example, the events in the film are recorded almost entirely without his on-screen intervention. He doesn't make himself the star or overtly insert his perspective as an interviewer or an on-camera persona. And you could very easily imagine, like, you know, like, ah, here's Nanook, take a look at him. And then the camera pans over and we see what the Inuit hunter is doing.
Right. Or like shots of Robert, whatever, like being taught something by Nanook. Like,
exactly.
This is how we fish in
He is an unseen persona, and we only, beyond just the opening title or inner titles of just explaining the context of him making the movie, like, we only get any perspective from him in terms of what he has chosen to film, which is significant in, you know, documentary in general. One of the most important things is, what are you selecting to film and to present to the audience? And then the occasional inner title, which is where, you know, things get a little stickier. But his subjects are the stars of the movie. It's a form of what you could call invisible documentary, where the proceedings are presented as though they're happening in real time or something approximating real time without really commenting on the observation. Also, and this is crucial, that he did without anybody having done it before. Like, he kind of set a template for anthropological documentary, which is that he involved his subjects in the filming of these events and in their depiction. He brought film printing equipment with him specifically so that he could screen his dailies for the subjects of the movie, and so that his Inuit subjects could offer comments about how they were depicted and whether or not what Flaherty was putting on screen was authentic. And then he incorporated their feedback. So, like, plenty of problems with the movie, a paternalistic point of view, but also he included them. And when they said, hey, you got this wrong, this is not how we would do it, or this doesn't feel accurate, they would do it again.
Except for when Nanook is biting a record. That still made it into the film.
For that. I'm just saying we gotta give him some credit.
Sure.
We gotta give him some credit.
Yeah, I mean,
he set precedents that other people who would go on to do what we now call anthropological documentaries have also done, which is you have to incorporate the subjects in their own depiction to have any kind of ethical perspective, especially if you're documenting a community that you are not a member of. You have to make them a part of it so that the depiction has, it gives it a sense of credibility. Even if the audience doesn't know, you know that it's credible, the thing that you're putting on screen.
Right. Okay.
That's very good.
There's a big hairy butt around the corner, right?
A lot of it's bullshit. This movie is sort of like the original sin of documentary film. So as Jamie alluded to from his Wikipedia reading, Nanook is an Inuit word for bear. And Flaherty liked that more than the dude's actual name, which, and forgive me, Inuit listeners or listener, is Alakarialuk. The family also is bullshit. The wives and the children were cast because they were good on camera. This was not a family unit whatsoever. I had even read, this is something that came up in a 1990 documentary called Nanook Revisited, that apparently those women were effectively Flaherty's common law wives, and they weren't even the real dude's wives.
So that's why he fell in love with
No, don't do that. No, I mean, maybe, but hopefully not.
Listen, man.
Hopefully not.
If it walks and quacks like a duck,
Whatever.
I'm not saying it definitely is, but I'm saying...
Just shut up. There's more for you to be offended by here than him going native, so to speak. He did also ask his subjects to enact more traditional versions of their like daily cultural activities. Like, for example, the Inuit in the 19-teens did not live in igloo. They had already adopted like southern building materials. Him building the igloo is real, right? Like, that's still a real skill that he demonstrably has. It's not fake, but it's not like their primary domicile. They also used rifles to hunt and didn't use spears. And apparently, since, you know, this was before the advent of sound filmmaking, apparently during the walrus hunt, some of the actual hunters on screen were like shouting back at Flaherty, like, dude, pick up the rifle, pick up the rifle, help us out. And he just pretended to ignore them because the spears fit into like the vision of these people that he wanted to present. And also like some of the incidents are just outright staged. the seal that our character Nanook catches and pulls out of the ice was actually already dead.
Of course.
And the rope that was pulling on him was just like run through pulleys to some of his friends off screen were pulling back on him. The igloo interiors were, so the funny thing about igloos is that you can't make them super big.
Right.
And they're too dark.
They'll collapse
and they're too dark to film inside, even with like the ice windows. And so Flaherty had them build larger ones and they collapsed multiple times. And then he was like, all right, well, what if we just made the windows bigger? And they also collapsed multiple times. So instead they just built half of a very large igloo that was still had like sunlight coming in. And that's where they filmed all of the interiors. But it's not 100% bullshit. Like, it's still a real walrus hunt that they filmed, even though the names of the people are not their actual names and the methods that they use are pretty outdated by then contemporary Inuit standards. Nanook, the man, Alakarialuk, really built that igloo with his real skills that had been passed down generations. He just doesn't live in those things all the time anymore. Like, it's all real. The things that you're witnessing are actually happening. They're all real. But it's not. And that's why this is like, you know, such an important piece of documentary, because this is the central tension of all of documentary filmmaking.
It shows like,
how much are we faking?
There's so much of like, as you said, the things he got right and the things he got wrong. Like there's a lot to aspire to and a lot to aspire not to.
Yeah.
Which was a bad sentence, and I don't apologize.
You should, but you won't. The stuff that we're talking about here has been in each of the two documentaries that we've covered on this show so far. This tension.
Only two?
I believe only two. We did Dick Johnson is Dead.
Yeah.
And we did Minding the Gap.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
I believe those are the only two that we've actually discussed on the show, but like, and in part because this is what I'm interested in documentary, a lot of documentary in the last like 50 to 60 years has been about interrogating this same tension, has been right. about either a response to the Flaherty's of the world. And there was this huge school of documentary, this like Verite school that was like, we're going to show you the unreality. Like, we'll make you aware of camera movement. We will include parts where the one cameraman catches the other cameraman on screen. We will allow the subjects to like in dialogue, interact with the camera operators, with the filmmakers, because by showing you how unreal it is, we just underline how the reality of it. You know, we're being more honest about it. That's where something like the works of the Maisels brothers, whose films in the like the 60s and the 70s are like so important to this new school of documentary film. Like Grey Gardens, have you ever, you never saw Grey Gardens? Grey Gardens feels like something your moms would have shown you.
This is the Maisels?
Yeah, this is the Maisels. This is like one of their big, big documentaries. And it's these like two New England, like older waspy white ladies who are like living in this house that they call Grey Gardens, and they're kind of isolated and they're cut off, and it's a mother and a daughter, and they're very eccentric, and like these two like young filmmakers come in and observe them but also interact with them on screen, and we see the two filmmakers, and you get a sense of like the tension between subject and filmmaker. And we question what is depicted and what is not depicted. And we allow the subjects to even comment upon whether or not they're comfortable with what's being depicted. So like that's all in response to this, you know.
This does look up my alley.
It's a great movie. You would really like it. They have another great documentary that was like one of their, probably their big breakout, which is a film called Salesman. That's just like this very, you know, naturalistic slice of life observation about like a traveling salesman.
That also sounds up my alley.
Yeah. But like without this movie, we don't have any of that. We don't have the works of Frederick Wiseman. We don't have the documentaries of Agnes Varda or Werner Herzog, or, you know, it's all of the like real documentary like wouldn't happen without this. And I'm things that are just like talking heads and video clips, I kind of put into a separate category. There's a time and a place for that. But like, I don't know, I'm more interested in like the rigorous stuff. And a lot of the really rigorous documentary tradition came out of this movie or as a response to this movie.
Like Grizzly Man.
Like Grizzly Man, of course, like Grizzly Man. But like that's the other thing with this movie is that it was a hit. Like it was very financially successful, which is part of why other documentaries were made after that.
Right.
Because it made that money, Jamie.
It's all about the Benjamins, baby.
That is what they say.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. It's dollar bills, y'all.
I wonder how many times in our friendship you have said all of those things to me in exactly that intonation.
Probably a lot. Probably like north of
a dozen times at least.
I was gonna say in the three digits.
It's a lot. Jamie loves to just like jump off of a thing somebody just said and just interject flat spoken word versions of like early hip hop.
It's, you know, these are the things that run through my head. And it's true. Cash rules everything around me. Is there anything in the room with you right now that cannot be related to cash flow, capitalism?
I'm just like not engaging on this. I'm not interested in this.
You started it.
No, you started it. You started it.
Okay, I started it, but you continued it, and then I responded to that energy.
Great. Sounds good.
And cash rules everything around me, all right?
Anyway, Nanook of the North. It's you know,
fine, or whatever.
Oh my God, I'm Jamie.
I didn't have a good time.
He didn't have a good time. He didn't have a good time. Jamie's got to have a good time. Everything's got to be good times for Jamie.
I like having a good time. Do you not like having a good time?
I do. I'm also able to like, I don't know. My version of a good time isn't just like happy feels and good vibes. Like I can have a good time with something that's like viscerally thrilling. Like I found this exciting, like even knowing all of like how much of it is bullshit. Like I still found it exciting. I still found it thrilling. I still liked, I mean, come on, Jamie, you're on fucking Instagram all the time. Didn't you like the part where he's playing with puppies? That's like straight up Instagram, like fucking catnip right there. You put that shit on TikTok where Nanook carves out using his like whale ivory knife, a little like bed out of the wall of an igloo and puts down some sticks and a fur and puts the puppies in there and then makes a little wall. So it's like a crib for the husky puppies.
Very
like,
cute.
Come
very,
on, man. It's cute. So cute.
I will say I was very stressed out by the dogs snarling and then the dogs fighting one another.
The dogs fighting was upsetting.
I was like, this is the fucking 1920s. These dogs are harming each other for sure.
You don't think Flaherty brought like a SPCA representative up there? I'm pretty sure I saw in the end credits that there was a no animals were harmed in the making of this film. Definitely yeah, nobody bet. Harmed that seal that was fucking carved up and de-blubbered on camera. That was all CGI. That was fake. Yeesh. Yeah, the stressful thing for me with the dogs is, yeah, the dogs are snarling while the hunters are carving up the dead seal and like eating parts of it seemingly raw. And then we just keep cutting back to the dog snarling and fucking flipping out, which of course is like Flaherty didn't have multiple cameras. So like those were obviously filmed in separate ways. And yet through the power of film, it just seems as though it's all just playing out for you in real time.
This dog is just like continually snarling and stressed out. And I'm just like, want to watch this dog that is like in distress right now.
Oh, I was more worried about the humans. See, I care about the people, and I was worried that the dog was going to like cut loose and eat one of those poor little kids that weren't related to anybody else who was in their family unit.
Well, there's that too, but like the dog also, the dogs don't snarl that hard because they're like malicious or malevolent. They do it because they're stressed.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not they're malicious or malevolent doesn't mean that they won't eat your face in that,
also true,
enraged attitude.
You know what else? There was the one intertitle where they're like explaining that the Inuit aren't blubber eaters, as is
right.
They use blubber like we use butter. And I was like, this shit. Like, sure, I guess you do want to say that. And if you're in love with this culture, you want to like quell misrepresentations. But like that also, like while we're watching shots of them eating raw walrus, just felt so fucking condescending. Like we use butter.
Well, they're all right. So, I mean, I guess the we use, but like it's a guy who knows his audience. He's trying to put it into a context that the audience will understand. Like, I guess he could have just said like they render blubber down like fat in the same way that we would with beef tallow. But like, I don't know, man, on the list of the movie's sins, like, I think
it's true.
Defending them from a pejorative term like blubber eaters is very low on the list.
That's fair. It stuck out to me because it was about food and I'm interested in food. I'm also interested.
I bet you would eat some walrus blubber.
100%.
Yeah, man. I would.
Hundo P, my friend.
I would eat a walrus given the opportunity. Oh, man.
I want to know what raw walrus tastes like. Walrus tartare, which is what they were having.
I feel like tartare, you have more kitchen expertise than I do, but there's a little bit more preparation than just carving it off the steaming dead carcass,
eating it hot.
Yeah.
Not hot from cooking, but hot from residual body heat.
Yeah. While a freezing, probably starving sled dog is losing his fucking mind, snarling and barking.
Oh my God. So stressful.
Those were some upset dogs.
They were not happy.
No, I'm sure it was fine. I'm sure that all happened naturally and that they weren't just like waving fucking sausages just off camera to flame that dog.
I fucking bet.
Look, I'm not saying Robert Flaherty was, you know, humanitarian of the year, but like he was a product of his time. It seemed like he was trying to do right by the people who were the subjects of his movie. And also, you know, he got documentary feature filmmaking started off on a simultaneously wonderful and terrible footing. It's complicated. It's tricky. Nanook of the North. Stream it now on Max and Canopy and YubTub.
Can we just keep calling it HBO Max? Cause like, I don't.
Oh, I'm already doing that on my Letterboxd tagging. I compulsively tag everything. So I can always at the end of the year, statistically say how much I'm using HBO versus Criterion versus Netflix, which is like largely a mathematical thing. Like, oh wow, I'm really not watching that much on Disney. Fucking cancel that shit.
Right.
But yeah, I'm still calling it HBO Max.
Good. Good. Good.
Also,
yes.
Speaking of things that are low on the list of sins, like David Zaslav, the CEO of Discovery Warner Media, whatever the fuck it's called now, like has done terrible things to the industry and to the company and tons of layoffs, and he's fucking my shit up with this app. But when you're browsing through on your Roku or your Chromecast or your smart TV interface and you're looking for the tile that has the different apps, HBO Max was the only purple one.
And now it's blue.
And now it's blue. So it's blue just like Prime, and it's blue just like Disney Plus. It's basically the same shade as Disney Plus. I'm pretty sure Paramount is also blue. Like the purple made it easier to find. It stood out. It was more aesthetically pleasing to have more of a rainbow and all the goddamn streaming channels I'm paying for.
I think you should write an email.
I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to go and join up one of the WGA protests and say, make the Max logo purple. It's more aesthetically pleasing when next to Netflix and Disney and Hulu to have a different color.
Make Max HBO again and purple again.
That's how I feel. That is how I feel.
So, Scott.
Jimbus Mohimbus.
I asked knowing the answer already, but is this pairing anything?
No, right? No. You know what? This might go pretty good with some raw walrus.
I was...
Maybe.
I've never had raw walrus.
That would be your rap name.
Is raw walrus.
If somebody ever convinced you that the terrible idea of you becoming a hip hop persona, you know, was something you should try, raw walrus. MC Raw Walrus.
That's so bad.
No, this pairing isn't anything.
It's zero things. It's nothing.
No. I kind of like this wine. I kind of like this movie. I have problems with both of them. But, you know, I at least found them both engaging and, like, pleasurable enough to keep going with.
I mean, I finished Nanook of the North. I just, like, by the end of it, I was like, okay, can this be done? Are we finished? Wow. Is this done yet?
Wow.
I was not with it, Scott.
Wow.
I wasn't picking up what it was putting down.
Typical millennial. Can only engage with things if it's on their fucking Instagram and Tim Tams, and it's a 10-hour Netflix movie and binge watching avocado toast.
I could go for some avocado toast, I'm not going to lie.
You know, I've never had it.
Nice runny egg on top.
I do like a runny egg.
Hell yeah.
Do you don't think this is a pairing?
No, this
right?
is nothing.
This is
no.
nothing.
I'm more
this
interested.
This was success then, because we didn't try, and therefore this meets that bar.
Yeah, it's fine. Like I would drink this wine and watch this movie, and I don't think the two would interact at all.
No, not even a little bit.
Nothing at all. But I like the wine a lot. I like it more with food.
Food?
And I would be open to trying it with a big, thick walrus steak. But I don't, there's not like a lot of availability of walrus meat, generally speaking. We don't really eat predators much.
It's because the carnivores are gamey, right? Because they're gamey. They're not that fatty because they struggle more.
There are also less of them, and they're less like nutritionally dense. Like just think about the flow of energy through an ecosystem. Like energy starts from the sun, is photosynthesized by plants, goes into herbivores, and then into carnivores. And at each point, you lose a bunch.
I think it's because they're gamey. And also because they're harder to murder, because they'll try and murder you back.
There's also that.
I'm trying to think what carnivores I've eaten now.
I've had alligator. Plenty of fish are like omnivores or carnivores.
That's true. I've had shark. I've had mako shark.
Yeah.
Delicious, delicious mako shark. Dolphin. Dolphin's a predator. I've eaten dolphin. Wait, no, I haven't. I thought I was eating dolphin, but then it was mahi-mahi. It's fucked up, man. You can't put on the specials menu dolphin steak and then expect me to know that you meant the dolphin fish. You can't do that.
Yeah,
that's why they have those different names.
That's deliberately misleading.
Yeah, to get people like me who want to eat an animal with, you know, like a 70 IQ or something.
You're terrible.
I mean, I wouldn't eat an endangered species because that's fucked up and illegal. But I would eat like a smart animal just once. Just once.
Oh, I mean, I mean,
I've eaten octopus. I've eaten plenty of octopus. And that I probably shouldn't do anymore. They can solve puzzles. We probably shouldn't eat them anymore.
Yeah, but they're really, really delicious.
They're really good. But like, I can't even solve a Rubik's Cube. Like, why am I going to fucking eat something that can? That's messed up.
Prepared by a chef of significant magnitude, there's not a lot that I would say no to.
Human.
Oh, 100%.
The most dangerous game.
Would absolutely eat a person.
That's fucked up. Well, James, it seems like we've come to the end of your 6-part tasting miniseries.
It seems that way.
And yet.
And yet we're doing a bonus episode. We're going for 7.
7. Lucky number 7. So Jamie, where are we going now? You've done your 3 reds and your 3 whites. Wait, but when is the actual tasting portion of the exam? Like if you get the thumbs up, knock on wood, that you pass theory, when is tasting?
September.
September.
Yeah.
All right.
In Houston.
In Houston, Texas.
That's correct. Yes.
So presuming that you've gone there, we've done 3 and 3, but so now, What are we doing? What's number 7?
Now we're actually going to do a blind wine, and I'm going to taste it blind on microphone, and I'm going to make a conclusion that will either, you know, make you very impressed, dear listener, that I can blind taste, or, you know, I'll be super duper fucking wrong.
Cool. So for the audience's point of view, drink something for next time if you drink when you're listening to the show. And yeah, we'll be blind drinking. I mean, it's always blind for me, but for Jamie this time, he'll actually not know what he's going into.
Yeah. So I'm going to get one of my Somme friends to get me a testable wine, and wrap it in tin foil. So I don't know what it is, and I'll pour it for myself and taste their own microphone. And I'll have that friend communicate to Scott, what the bottle is and how to get it.
So anyway, Jamie's doing a blind thing, and this works out nicely because I would like to tack one more thing on to the film school classics, which is a film by Kenneth Anger. Kenneth Anger, an icon of American queer cinema, passed away just a few days ago as of this recording. And so we'd like to recognize that. And also it's thematically very appropriate because I watched this particular film, Scorpio Rising, many a time in the film schoolings. This is a major piece of like the American avant-garde independent cinema. As I said, it's a major piece of like, or a foundational text in American queer cinema. And it's hugely referenced by a ton of filmmakers and beloved by many an influential person. Weirdly, like none of the Anger body of work is streaming right now, like free streaming. But you can check out Scorpio Rising on your VOD services for a relatively inexpensive rental. And this movie is from 1963 or 64, so it's not in that there public domain, so your creative YouTubery, should you seek the movie out that way, will not be legal, and therefore I do not endorse it. But yeah, Scorpio Rising, Kenneth Anger, 28 minutes long, I think Jamie will like it, and I'll look forward to seeing it again, because I haven't seen it since school, and that's been many years.
Yeah, don't do the math, it's bad math. That's the devil's math. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
I thought you were thanking me there for a second. Like, oh, that was a nice thing for me. No, that's okay.
Thank you, Scott, also, for being such a good sport and for putting together a parallel to my CMS curriculum. I feel like I am richer for having watched many, though not all, of these movies from your film schooling.
You didn't watch all of them?
I feel like I'm richer for some of them and not.
Oh, okay. Well, I feel like I'm poorer for having bought six $30 to $35 bottles of wine, some of which I enjoyed. But I feel like I've learned a little bit as well, because I today learned about the Fiasco bottle. I remembered it.
Love it.
A whole 2 hours later.
A whole 2 hours later, it's the Fiasco bottle.
Chianti in a Fiasco.
Now it's cemented in your head.
Check in with me tomorrow. Then we'll see if it's in there.
I'll bring a Fiasco to our next gathering and we'll see if you can identify it on site.
I'll just stare at you blankly. Yeah.
Thank you everyone for joining us. Please follow us on all the social medias. That's the Tim Tams, the Yub Tubs, the Instagrams, the Facebooks, and the Twitters, all at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any questions, concerns, complaints, or international reviews at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our art is by Ross Connor. Thank you very much, Ross. And also special thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with social media and project management.
Please remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.